This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Timothy Mitchell says that calls to reopen the economy obscure the reality that we don't all live in the same one. But there's another problem with expecting the government to flip a switch, as Derek Thompson wrote in The Atlantic this week. What economy will we see when the lights come back on? And wait, can the government even do that?
Sometimes we get the framing wrong because we assume that it's the government alone that can open and close an economy. Economies are co-opened and co-closed by both the government and the public. So look, for example, at restaurants. OpenTable has some really good data about the number of people who are making bookings on their restaurants. Right now, it's exactly zero across most of the United States. But what's really interesting is if you look at March, you'll see that before a lot of cities shut down their restaurants, restaurant bookings on OpenTable had already declined by 70%. So that door had been closed by the public before the government came in and said, okay, everything is closed officially.
A lot of the debate about restarting the economy suggests that there's a choice between saving the economy and saving lives. But that isn't what economists have told you, right?
Every economist that I've spoke to has said the exact same thing. Listen to the public health experts. There is near absolute unity among an enormous swath of the economic community and the epidemiology community, which is saying we need to do better to test, to trace, to isolate, to treat before we, quote unquote, open up this economy full bore.
You wrote that Denmark has frozen their economy in place, kind of like a patient who's struggling for life being put into a temporary medically induced coma.
They essentially said, what we need to do is freeze the economy. We need workers to stop working. We need companies to stop being companies. It is a bit like, as you said, putting a patient under a medically induced coma. The patient is still getting necessary life support. So what they would do is pay every company's payroll and utility for essentially 2.5 to 3 months and open things up a little bit more slowly. The U.S. has taken a bit more of a patchwork approach. We've said, all right, people can be laid off, and we'll have unemployment insurance waiting for them. We'll also have these checks that we'll mail out for $1,200 to adults and an extra $500 to some kids. And then what we'll also do is roll out this small business loan package, PPP, the Payroll Protection Plan, which is paying companies to not fire their workers. We're saying, if you fire your workers, they'll get money. But also, don't fire your workers. We'll give you money to not do that. I think it's clearer to do what Denmark has done, to make a very clear announcement to the entire economy that says, we don't want people to be fired. We want to freeze them where they are right now in their jobs so that they aren't going on unemployment, so that they aren't being sort of dislodged from employers who then have to hire them back in the summer. I do think that the Danish plan was a little bit more sensible in that regard.
When the people and the government reopen the economy, it'll be a very different one from what we had in February. And I really want you to take us through the steps that you think will land us at your vision of what the future holds. But first, walk with us down a typical retail street that your reporting suggests will exist in the aftertime.
When you walk down the streets right now, what you tend to see is a long line of dark windows. And I'll give you sort of three quick predictions that I made after talking to a number of experts, academics, and business owners. The first prediction is that the bigger are going to get bigger. You're going to see a lot of mom and pops that just can't hold their breath through the next few months. They're going to go out of business, and a lot of that business is going to flow to chains. That's prediction number one. Prediction number two is in the restaurant business. This year will be the first year on record where so-called off-premise spending in restaurants will exceed the dine-in business. And that's going to last. Food that can be delivered is essentially the future of the business. And there's a handful of really interesting and sometimes dark implications of that. Like, for example, really complex haute cuisine might not do very well if it sits in the back of a car for 35 minutes. But what we already know does very well in the back of a car for 35 minutes is pizza. Pizza is already 60% of all delivery in the U.S. So I think that you could see foods that deliver well expanding their footprint of the American restaurant business.
And from the unintended consequences file, you made a fascinating point in that piece about what happened to America's diet as a consequence of prohibition.
Right. So it was exactly 100 years ago that the 18th Amendment was passed, which banned the production and sale of alcohol. And prohibition only lasted about a decade, but it cast a really long shadow over the restaurant landscape, and it changed the taste of American food, the literal taste. A lot of fine dining restaurants closed because their profit was dependent upon their ability to sell alcohol. As a result, a lot of restaurants shifted from the fine dining world that had taken off in the early 20th century to the rise of lunch car diners. And lunch car diners specialized in what diners specialize in now. It was food that kids could enjoy with sober parents, you know, hot dogs and hamburgers and milkshakes. That kind of American menu took over the U.S. restaurant industry in the middle of the 20th century, such that by the time you had a bunch of fast food companies getting started, like McDonald's, it was the same palate. Every meal was fit for a kid. You could argue that this period sort of infantilized the American palate.
But if you liked a certain kind of food, food that was hot, unexpected, combined different ingredients, vinegary, whatever it is kids don't like, that desire, does it just go away?
More likely, cooking at home becomes more interesting and dining out becomes less interesting.
Ah.
We have the ability to make all sorts of fascinating foods in our own kitchens. The size of American kitchens has increased, the number of cookbooks have increased. But that same kind of sophisticated food that people might be experimenting with at home doesn't hold up in the back of a car for 45 minutes coming from that great restaurant that you used to love.
So the sterile fast food places that some of us love to hate wouldn't succeed if the public didn't think they were safer. And so businesses who are most sensitive and adaptable to keeping people healthy will do the best.
I do think that you're going to see a lot of consumers make decisions about which restaurants seem to give the most attention to public health. I think you could see more temperature checks at doors, more hand sanitizer within the restaurant, much more space between the tables, maybe even separators between tables. Menus are less likely to be fine paper and more likely to be laminated so that they can be wiped down. You're going to see a lot of elements of the restaurant experience and really just the public retail experience tinged with it, with this sense of hygiene to make people trust that they can be out in public again.
JetBlue just announced that it'll require masks on their flights.
Mm-hmm.
That's another illustration of what you're talking about. But I know you focused on restaurants because they are in the front line for expressing the character of a city. And cities in general, you suggest, will become far less appealing, right? If they're no longer vital or varied or interesting, if they're not those things, then why not move to the cheaper suburbs or exurbs?
Yeah, I have a short-term and long-term prediction.
Well, start with the short term. What happens to cities overall after the pandemic?
This plague is a perfect storm for destroying what many people love most about cities. People move to cities because of their crowds, because of their variety, and their capacity to surprise.
And what gives them that?
Well, immigrants give them that. Density of people, the sense of public safety. You know, New York in 2019 was safer than almost, you know, any city in American history on a per-person basis. And so I do think that cities will change. They will feel more desolate. They'll feel more empty. They'll feel less alive and less exciting. And a lot of people will leave. And a lot of people who might have come to cities will choose not to go there. But I also think that ecosystems change in response to change. If New York becomes a little bit quieter and a little more desolate and a little bit less desirable, and not just New York, but a lot of other cities around the country, rents will come down, which means that the middle class will be able to move back into cities, and that could potentially make cities even more interesting than they were in 2019.
Not just the middle class. The marginalized people, the artists, the quirky people that give the city its richness.
Yes, they might have this window to move back into cities and they could make them interesting and exciting again.
When do you see that happening?
I think of it happening in the next few years. I think that the next year, say the next 12 to 18 months are going to be really tough for the character of American cities. And that after that, we might see a bit of a rebirth or a regrowth.
This pandemic has exposed so many of our society's fault lines. And it's also given new life to some long debated potential solutions like universal basic income or banning evictions. perspectives, you can read them. They range from the apocalyptic, we're doomed, to the upbeat, we can rise from these ashes as a better, wiser people. Your piece paints a picture where, at least initially, only the strong survive, the biggest businesses swallowing up the small. It's pretty grim because the pandemic seems to be metastasizing this American disease of inequality that's eating away at us.
To employ a metaphor, this would be a bit like a forest fire. It leaves ruin, it leaves devastation. But then after a forest fire, sunlight reaches the floor of the forest and new species grow, sometimes more diverse and more resilient, and the forest fills out again. And I think that the same could happen to a lot of American cities, that after the fire of the pandemic burns through them and they lose a lot of their idiosyncrasies and eccentricities and their character, and some people move out, and a lot of people feel like a lot of American cities have been ruined, there will be an opportunity for new people to move into them, for the artists and the counterculturalists and the weirdos and people who are more eccentric, for immigrants to move back as well. Middle-class immigrants will be able to, you know, afford more in cities maybe than they can afford today, and the cities will be remade. You know, you look at the history of American cities, and it is a history of calamity. It's earthquakes, and it's fires, and it's floods, and they keep coming back. And so any prediction that says that this is the end of American cities is an ahistorical prediction. It's literally predicting the end of history.
I was just wondering about the journalistic exercise of writing this kind of informed projection. Your piece is well-reported. You've spoken to experts. You've scrutinized current trends, historical precedent. But what do you think the role is of this kind of detailed imagining, of speculation, at a time when our future is already so uncertain?
I think that people need concrete visions of the future. We're living through such a strange and awful purgatory that we need to be offered options for a path out. And I do think that it falls to not just our political and business leaders, but also to journalists to begin to sketch possible paths out of this purgatory. I think that our leaders need help. They need to be able to say, okay, well, what are different futures we can nudge our people toward? And here I'm taking a lot of things that are already happening. You already see the acceleration of big business. You already see the decimation to dine-in restaurants. I'm suggesting plausible ways that could shake out to change the American city, but then I'm trying to suggest a positive vision for how we can make cities better. It begins with, you know, allowing rents to fall a little bit, liberalizing immigration law to allow more immigrants to come into cities, to start new companies, whether they're restaurants or dry cleaners or high-tech companies. That's the beginning of the future that I imagine for us.
So this forest fire of which you speak, do you think it was already underway?
You could say, extending the metaphor, that some of the sparks were already in existence. There were little smolderings everywhere throughout the forest. The reason the forest fire metaphor stuck with me is that it doesn't force me to make a determination about whether this is good or bad. It is good and bad side by side. It is burning, and it is regrowth and rebirth. It's sadness and the possibility of a better future juxtaposed.
Derek, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Derek Thompson covers economics and technology for The Atlantic.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Lana Casanova-Burgess, Michael Loewinger, Leah Feder, John Hanrahan, Zandra Ellen, and Eloise Blondio. This week, we bid a social distanced farewell to our intern, Anthony Bansi. Anthony, thank you for all your help and good luck with everything. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Josh Hahn.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer, and she's back. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.